This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Consensus for American Security member Philippe Maize-Sancier, Senior Director for Europe at McClarty. Philippe, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Maggie.
So there are a lot of things we could talk to you about because you are the Senior Director for Europe, which not of Europe, as I so think you would maybe rather be. But there's lots happening in Europe these days. We have a big NATO summit coming up, am I right?
I think you're right indeed. A couple of weeks.
So let's start there. NATO summit, what's on the agenda?
This has been said pretty widely as being a make or break, or probably one of the most important summits in the last 10 to 15 years of NATO. We're looking at a couple of things. Reassurance for a number of Eastern European countries. A way of keeping the alliance together. The alliance is really being pulled apart by different strategic needs, perspectives, and real questions about the role of the U.S., whether right now, under the current administration, or under whichever administration comes out of this year's elections. One of the things that is really important to understand, and perhaps not underlined enough here on this side of the Atlantic, are the real divergence that you're starting to see within NATO allies as to what they feel is an existential threat to their interest or to their regions within the NATO alliance. If you take a lot of the Eastern European countries, from the Balts to the Poles to probably the Romanians and Bulgarians, obviously Russia's new assertiveness is certainly very high on the agenda. If you look at Germany, Austria, a number of the southeastern European states in the Balkans, what really matters today are the refugee flows and how do you address that, whether from an internal point of view or how do you stem that flow. If you're looking at some of the more Western countries, Italy, France, certainly, the UK most probably, the fight against ISIS, Daesh, whichever one you, you know, whichever
pick
name you
choice,
want to,
yeah.
to use, and terrorism are really at the heart of what people would consider today as an existential threat. The Poles want to see strong commitment from the alliance towards deterrence and making sure that the Russians understand that they shouldn't be playing around with fire, whether actually heavy armored brigades are what we need to do that or not is a real question. I am not sure. The French will tell you that they want to make sure that NATO remains balanced in its views. And while the East is definitely high on their agenda, dealing with the South, and I would say the South and the Southeast, from the Levant to Egypt to Libya, which is very high on the agenda in Italy and France, and West Africa, remain something very high on those countries' agenda in terms of priority that should be addressed, if not directly by NATO, with NATO support.
So that's a very large region, right? The Levant through Egypt, West Africa, and I think, sometimes U.S. geography kind of smushes it all together. And there's significant nuance there, but some very similar underlying themes, certainly a strong red thread, so to speak. And what do you think the role of NATO is in this, dare I say, region, which of course it is not one coherent region, but somewhat related to one another and facing similar challenges? What do you think the role of NATO is there?
In my mind, NATO can't be taking a primary focus, a primary role. This is out of area. What should or needs to happen is probably a better understanding within the alliance of some of the threats that the continent is facing because of what is happening in those regions. We've seen the result of refugee flows from the Syrian conflict. If you like Syria, I like to think that Libya could be a fantastic second
vacation.
Yes.
Interesting.
What ISIS trying to take a foothold in Libya,
sure.
Being able to push the same issues, not only of Libyans, but also opening the floodgates for economic migrants from Africa or from North Africa trying to enter Europe and destabilize the continent. Looking at short, medium, and long term, there are real reasons why the alliance should be looking at its southeastern and southern flank more than it does today, but probably more as a support role to EU-led or member state-led interventions. If one looks at the Franco-British Libya intervention in 2011, and I don't mean what happened as a result of that intervention, but rather the way that intervention was carried out with two NATO and EU core members taking the lead on that intervention, but relying on NATO-US support to bridge some of the gaps or capability lacks that they were facing. I believe that this is probably the way forward. Not that the US needs to be involved in everything, but the alliance and therefore the US have an interest in making sure that some of the issues which are destabilizing the continent right now are being addressed and are being addressed in the best possible way. That doesn't mean necessarily a NATO intervention per se, but probably NATO support to some of the intervention if they are of the military nature.
And while that intervention is ongoing, what do you think the role of NATO countries and also EU member states are? We talk about this flow of refugees. What happens during the intervention? You know, what becomes of these people, and what are the responsibilities, whether moral or otherwise, that various NATO countries or EU member states may have?
Do you mean if there were an intervention somewhere in North Africa, for instance?
Yeah, and you know, as the conflict, I'm thinking first in Syria, and then potentially with an intervention in, or continued intervention in Libya, as we work to resolve these underlying issues, it doesn't deal with the immediate. So what do we do about the immediate?
Well, there are a number of things, and they're all complicated, and there's no easy answer. My personal belief is that Chancellor Merkel was right in taking the high moral road that she did take last year in welcoming refugees, because there's no other alternatives.
Right.
What was wrong and what went wrong after that is that that open door, for the right reasons, became an open door not just for war refugees, but if you look at the numbers of people who actually went through southeastern Europe, Austria, and Germany to end up either in Germany or in the Nordic countries, in Sweden in particular, at least or about half of those people were not Syrian refugees, but were actually economic migrants. And I know that a number of people will make the argument that Europe needs those migrants today for many different reasons, demographic and so on.
Sure.
But the mood in Europe is not that right now. I think we do have a duty, looking at what is happening in Syria, to address some of the humanitarian failings that have come as a result of that. And the German Chancellor was right to take the high moral vote that she took. The confusion, of course, happened between economic refugees and political or war-torn refugees. And that's not an easy distinction to make. Nonetheless, it should have been made and should be made. I also want to look at some of the peripheral countries there.
Absolutely.
Because one focuses on Europe today, but if you look at a country which is very dear to my heart, Lebanon, you know, 4 million Lebanese.
Dear to my heart as well. Yeah. It's an interesting situation, to say the least.
Yeah. 4 million Lebanese, 1.2 million refugees,
and
nobody, nobody cares about, you know, the
and
only
a governance structure that absolutely cannot support
that cannot support it.
Yeah.
A government support structure, a sociological and religious structure that can't deal with it today and that
is
dealing with it.
Garbage truck system that cannot deal with it, absolutely.
Only one country has financially come to the support of Lebanon,
sure.
And to, unfortunately, I'd rather, you know, we're talking about 100 million euros, not what Lebanon needs.
Sure.
You know, the ties between France and Lebanon are what they are, and that is why that country acted, but 100 million euros is not going to make a difference. Jordan is facing exactly the same issues, and actually Jordan is a critical ally to the United States and to the West, and nobody talks about what's happening in Jordan or in terms of support that's being provided to Jordan.
Right.
Turkey is in a difficult place and is also playing a very murky role.
Yeah, and when you think about the role they're playing, which I will absolutely ask you to describe in the context of the EU or their desire for the EU, that's obviously shifting. It's a very interesting consideration.
Again, these are very personal views. I think the number of things that need to be put on the table. Number one, Turkey has taken on, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, over 2 million refugees, and that should be underlined.
Yes.
You know, Germany is having a hard time dealing with 1 million, and Germany is the
EU's fully functioning government.
A fully functioning government with major economic resources and an infrastructure that, although is being tested, is able to handle, as we can see, the influx of refugees. Turkey is in a very different position as a country, having to deal with terrorist threats. Today, again, Istanbul was racked by bombing. That being said, the Turkish authorities are playing a very interesting role. And as a European, I think that Europe, as much as Chancellor Merkel was on the right path and chose the moral high ground and was right to do that when welcoming the Syrian refugees, I think that Chancellor Merkel going to Ankara to deal with no mandate with the current president of the Turkish Republic, a deal that actually is probably going to go nowhere, was not the right thing to do, has undermined Germany and the Chancellor's ability to operate in Europe, and is actually providing Mr. Erdogan with the wrong kind of endorsement and reassurance. Because the Turks, whatever money they may be getting from the EU, will keep on playing that card to their advantage and may stem for a while the flow of refugees, but it is not a long-term solution.
Absolutely. You alluded to briefly earlier the mood in Europe, which I don't know if it's possible to overstate the importance of the mood in Europe in such a wide variety of ways. How would you describe the mood in Europe, and how do you think it's impacting everything that's going on?
Let me start by a small example that hopefully will help shape our chat the next few minutes. I think this Friday, Euro 2016 is starting. This has traditionally been, for football aficionados, or you say soccer here?
Yeah, football is fine for us.
This is the biggest feast.
It's no Copa Americana, but it's fine.
It's across Europe. You know, this is a time where people will travel, where people will stop working to watch together at work, in bars, at home, something which brings people together.
Sure.
Today, God knows how many millions will travel, probably not that many, because everybody is scared of a potential terrorist attack on one of the stadiums. That's the mood in Europe, something which should be bring us all together, which should be joy, fun, and good spirit competition between countries which used to do the same type of thing on a battlefield, is actually a scary event. And I'm willing to bet that a number of people in Paris can't wait for this to be over and hopefully over with no incident.
Yeah.
If you are European today, you're 25 or under, you're having an extremely hard time getting a job. You're seeing jobless rates double digits and above in many countries.
Sure.
You are seeing anti-TTIP, anti-everything demonstrations. If you look around news program in the evening, you will probably hear about Syria, about Egypt, about the Middle East, about Ukraine, about no growth in Europe. about another meeting of EU member states in Brussels that has not delivered, about Brexit, which one way or the other is a pretty dire, will come out to a pretty dire outcome in my mind. So the mood in Europe is doom and gloom. And doom and gloom has already happened. The problem is I find today that there is not much to show a path forward. That sounds somewhat better, or that offers some sort of relief, and more importantly, a reason to believe that things are going to be better. For a number of European parents today, people who've grown up, the baby boomers or the next generation, for whom the European Union was an obvious plus and something which had changed lives, both in terms of making war impossible or unthinkable on the continent, but also in providing the framework for more prosperity. Everything is being put up in the air right now. People don't really know what they should be doing or following, and what will provide their children with actually a brighter future.
And I wonder what you think is needed to start formulating a path forward. I mean, one thing that comes to my mind almost immediately is you hinted at briefly the special relationship, dare I say, between France and Lebanon. And in our minds as we're talking, you know, we discussed how what's happening in the Levant, going over to Egypt, to West Africa, to Libya, it all sort of blends together. And it almost seems now that the Mediterranean Sea acts as a very strong horizontal line, and that we've forgotten not just the humanity of the situation, but there's a lot of shared culture.
Ties.
There's a lot of ties there. And so, I don't know, do you think that getting back to moving away from this isolationist, you know, out of fear or whatever, this isolationist perspective, and maybe starting by remembering what we have in common, do you think that will help us find a way out? Or is it going to take more than that?
You use a very interesting, I think, the right word, fear, which had been taken out of, I think, a number of Europeans' minds and psyche.
Yeah.
And it's suddenly back. Let me take a step back, because I think you're absolutely right. I think one shouldn't forget history, which one has had a tendency to forget over time recently.
We're good at that.
I think we all are.
Yeah.
And there definitely are links across the Mediterranean basin that are being rekindled or should not be underestimated. Nonetheless, there are also big issues in the East, and I really do not want, you know, we've been talking a lot about the southern flank of the continent. There are real issues on the East too. But to answer your question more directly, I think we need to take a step back and start listening to a few things. European people have been telling us for actually probably 20 years already that they are dissatisfied with the way the European Union was developing and what was happening in Brussels. They are telling us, or they have been telling us, that they feel decisions are being taken remotely. They don't feel a connection with what's happening in Brussels, or that Brussels is mingling into their lives in ways that it should never do. The famous size of the cucumber that you're allowed to, you know, sell on a market in Italy or in Greece is defined in Brussels. Having grown up in southwestern France, a very agricultural based area, I can recall farmers telling me, you know, doing foie gras or other and doing homemade goods that were being sold on markets, being forced by the EU under hygiene grounds to create real lab-like facilities,
right,
which were outlandishly expensive for them to do and would force them out of business and create a lot of resentment at very basic level,
right,
against, you know, what was being taken out in Brussels. When the Irish voted a few years ago on the on the European matter and voted no, and were told in no uncertain terms that, oh, well, that wouldn't do. Would you mind re-voting a second time because we didn't like what you told us? What kind of respect for democracy and for what a people has said is,
right,
that when you force them to re-vote so that they actually vote in the correct fashion?
Is it voting then?
when the Netherlands and France in 2005, both founding members of the EU, or at the time the European Communities, vote no against constitution, you should wonder how those countries, which are the forefront of the European construction, find themselves in a position where they actually don't want to see that construction go any further. Mm-hmm. Despite all this, we find ways, like the Lisbon Treaty, to get back on the on track
and
do things that people tell us they don't want us to do. I think we need to take a step back. We need to realize that nation states, or nations in any event, have not been erased despite 60 years of living together peacefully. And actually, that is good.
Right.
One can be English, Welsh, Scottish, French, Basque,
Lebanese.
Well, Lebanese in Europe,
yeah,
not
it's
yet.
A little,
but
it could happen.
But Slovak or Hungarian and be European, there should be no reason why one should be opposed to the other.
Absolutely.
Which means looking at what we've built and making sure that we take a step back and we give back to the countries or to the nations more say. And if that means institutional changes, we should look at that too, to make sure that people who feel represented by the national parliaments, by their MPs, feel that they say is being heard in Brussels too, and that they have some sort of control of what is happening. I know that you will say, well, they are represented in the council. They are. Does it mean that they feel that? Obviously not. I think that our politicians from across the continent need to be courageous enough to also tell European peoples that there are matters that cannot be or are best handled at a union level, because it is the right level in terms of being able to address these issues. And immigration is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that Germany alone or Sweden or, you know, Slovakia or Hungary, by erecting walls and barriers, will be able to deal with that problem is ludicrous. It can only be dealt with by the union, because this is the right level.
Mm-hmm.
That means that a lot of things need to be put into place, that countries need to start talking about each other, to each other again, that they need to listen and understand where they're coming from, and that they need to be putting solidarity back where it should be, at the heart of what Europe is all about. Stop thinking just about themselves, but start thinking about the bigger picture, because whatever barrier has been erected in Hungary or in Slovakia or on the Brenner Pass between Italy Austria, may work for the next 2 or 3 months, but it will not work in the next year or so.
Yeah.
This can only be addressed if we work together. So, sorry, long, so convoluted way to getting back to your question, but I think two things need to be done, which may seem as being divergent, but actually, on the contrary, are self-reinforcing, on the things that need to be done and can best be done at the national level. There need to be re-empowerment. And yes, if that means that we are not going to be having a federal Europe in the next 10 years, well, I think I've got news for anybody who's listening to this and believe there will be a federal Europe in the next 10 years.
What planet
that
are you on?
That is not going to happen.
Yeah.
It took 80 years for America to get there in very different times. If maybe one day we'll get there, it will have to mean that we will have overcome our current issues today. And our current issues mean being able to address the national and not the nationalist urge that people have to feel that their community, their national community, which is what they feel naturally akin to, is being heard, being listened to, and its interests are being addressed, while not losing sight of the fact that some of these issues cannot be addressed by Slovenia or Luxembourg alone, but will need to be addressed by the Union. And that means, in particular, looking at the external borders of the continent, but also some of the economic integration that needs to happen and some of the reforms that need to happen to make sure that the continent gets back on the growth path and is able to deliver on some of the things that matter to those 25-year-old we mentioned early on, jobs.
Yeah, Well, Philippe, I'm going to ask you the same last question we ask all our guests, as you're chuckling, as everyone does when I get ready to ask them this, and you all know it's coming. So what's next, 20 years down the road, whether we do it right or we do it wrong, what does the world look like? And I think we know a federated Europe is not happening, so we can take that off the table. But if we don't start not just talking to each other, but listening to each other, what does the world look like in 20 years?
If we do it wrong, and right now we're on the path of doing it wrong, doesn't mean it will happen, but if we do it wrong, things are not going to be looking very good.
Right.
Europe, as far as I'm concerned, is on the verge of walking out of history, which is incredible for a place in the world that has been at the forefront of history for the last 1,500 years, or 15 to 2,000 years. It is at the verge of walking out because we are tired people, because the world is changing, and instead of embracing that change for everything it has to bring Europe, we are fearing it.
Mm-hmm.
We are fearing it because it is challenging a lot of the things that we believe, or the comfortable world we were living in. Having said all this, I think Europe, because of its diversity, because of its 1,500 years of history, because of its opening to the world, and because of the fact that it is not just, well, actually today, no longer a military power, but a power that is also able to use soft power and have different channels of engaging, actually could have a very bright future. It doesn't mean it shouldn't have hard power. Europe needs to revisit its last 60 years of history and realize that the world is changing, and will need at some point, sometimes, to have perhaps a harder answer that the Europeans have had. If we don't do things right, Brexit, the English will be out of the European Union. I think that Brexit, if that happens, will be terrible for the UK, because I doubt that the UK will stay together. I believe that some of the nations of the British Isles will want to have a different deal, and probably a deal closer to the continent than the one they have today.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe that a Europe dominated by France and Germany is good. Both countries, for different reasons, need the UK to be the free trade, down to earth.
It has always been this way,
and it has been this way, and that is why it worked.
Right.
We don't need more state intervention, but we also need the worldview that the French or the British have. And Germany, for many reasons, does not want to be left alone as the hegemon of Europe. It is
not
in that
sure
position.
Any of us are interested in that either.
I think a lot of people may feel antsy about that, but the Germans themselves don't want it.
Right.
At the same time, we need to have some way of making sure that when Angela Merkel takes the high road and the moral road, she is not left alone hanging the way she has been.
Absolutely.
If things go right, we will have a model which will be different from the one we have today, but will have proved that there is something else out there beyond big states like China or the US that can be more than Mercosur, and that can bring prosperity and a common vision to peoples that had a tendency to deal with each other by hitting each other on the head rather than working together. I am old enough to belong to what is called the Erasmus generation, which is something amazing that happened in Europe when that grand giving body was created, allowing young Europeans to go and study somewhere else in the EU and find a second home. I hope that in 20 years down the road, that has not been broken down, and that we have managed to overcome some of the issues that we are facing today, perhaps because of that generation of people who feel as much at ease in Rome, in Malmö, in Budapest, as they do back home, and are able to see that solidarity and what brings us together is bigger than what tears us apart today. I hope that's not fanciful dreaming.
I hope it's not fanciful dreaming either, because it sounds like a good idea. Well, so Philippe Maisoncier, thank you for joining us. It's been wonderful having you. This is What's Next from ASP. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilkey.